From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is the current Washington stalemate a taste of the future? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In Washington today, a reported deal to reopen the government and raise the debt limit by Thursday was on again, off again. Deal or no deal, there's no guarantee that another similar crisis won't arise a few weeks from now. Tea Party Republicans want an end to business as usual, and new sources of funding allow them to thumb their noses at the traditional GOP. Who's in control on Capitol Hill? What about next year's elections? Is real compromise possible in Washington's 24-hour goldfish bowl? Today's talking point, will the U.S. Supreme Court put an end to affirmative action? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. House Republicans have cast doubt on a bipartisan Senate plan for reopening the government and raising the debt limit by Thursday. Will business as usual become a thing of the past in Washington? We'll talk about the long-term future. Today's talking point, Michigan voters prohibited the use of race for admission in public universities. Does that violate the right of equal protection? We'll hear about today's arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. First is news update. As the Senate leaders of both parties appeared to have reached a compromise with a vote likely tomorrow, House Republicans met this morning to add new provisions that could stymie the process of reopening the government and raising the debt ceiling 2 days from now. But when Speaker John Boehner met reporters, he said this.
There are a lot of opinions about what direction to go. There have been no decisions about what exactly we will do. But we're going to continue to work with our members on both sides of the aisle to try to make sure that there's no issue of default and to get our government reopened.
Moments later, House Democrats came to the same microphone. Here's the minority leader and former speaker, Nancy Pelosi.
What you saw here earlier, was that here where they were? The speaker was here?
Yes.
Was a speaker who did not have the votes for his proposal. If there's any hope here is that they don't have the vote. So why are they doing this to the American people, sabotaging a good faith bipartisan effort coming out of the Senate?
Janet Hook is congressional correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Always good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be with you.
So what's the difference between what the Senate has come up with and what the House might or might not have come up with?
Well, what Speaker Boehner did was put before his Republican conference this morning a proposal that was had some of the same elements as the House, the Senate bill. Most important ones were reopen the government until January 15th, extend the debt limit until February 7th. But he added back a provision that had been talked about in the Senate, but they put it on the side, which was a 2-year delay on a tax on medical devices. It's a little piece of Obamacare, and it's almost like Republicans are looking to put some kind of stamp on this compromise that House Republicans can say is their own. They don't. One thing that House members really don't like is just being asked to swallow something produced by the Senate. So there is a little bit of just the House Republicans wanting to have an impact. There is also this a kind of procedural question that actually if that bill starts in the House and then goes to the Senate, it might move faster. And right now, really, time is of the essence.
But the White House immediately said it didn't like the House additions. Isn't that right?
Exactly right. Both the White House and Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, stepped out and really slammed Speaker Boehner in his proposal. And it's really, right now, everybody's sort of at sixes and sevens trying to figure out what happens next. One effect of Speaker Boehner trying to put something together is it kind of put on hold the negotiations that had been going on between Senator Reid and McConnell to finalize the details of the Senate compromise. So I think they're kind of waiting to see what happens in the House before they move forward on that. So even though we only have 2 days before this supposed deadline on Thursday, actually right before our very eyes, nothing is happening.
This is To the Point from PRI. We're talking with Janet Hook, who's congressional correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. The Republicans, Boehner and others, talked about fairness. That seems to relate to a provision they want to insert that would deny special medical coverage to members of Congress and members of the White House and the cabinet.
That is a provision that they've added. The rhetoric is a little bit misleading. They talk about members of Congress getting special treatment. What it is they want there to be no longer they don't want members of Congress or their staff, though it's not clear whether the staff would be included, to continue to get government subsidies for their health care premiums as they do now. They're being required under the health care law to go into these exchanges that now exist for people looking for individual health coverage. So the effect would be to dramatically increase the cost of premiums for the people who had been getting employer subsidies in terms of the staff. But the version that Speaker Boehner put before the Republicans would cut off these subsidies, basically increase the cost of premiums for members of Congress, the president, the vice president, and the cabinet. The question then was whether they would extend that to include congressional aides as well.
So let me get this clear then. If, in fact, the House were to pass the bill with these additions in it, it would then go to the Senate, and the Senate could pass it. That would be the fastest way for the bill to move. Why wouldn't the passage by the Senate and then reference to the House move just as quickly?
There's a kind of a complicated parliamentary. Well, here's the thing is. There's a possibility that opponents of any of these bills could use a filibuster or other delaying tactics in the Senate. We don't know whether they will or not. Ted Cruz has been silent on whether he would. He's our most famous senator for filibusters here. If the House starts the bill and sends it to the Senate, there's only one opportunity to filibuster. If the Senate starts it, this is just for parliamentary reasons, there are two opportunities. So that's why, just as a procedural matter, it works faster if it starts in the House. But the fact of the matter is, for anything to move in time before the Thursday deadline, there's going to have to be broad consensus. There's going to have to be unanimous consent in the Senate to move something quickly.
Okay. Janet Hook, congressional correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We'll be back in a moment and continue this conversation about what's happening in Washington and what it could mean for the future on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and I'll be back to the point. Just to recap what we have heard, it appeared that Senate leaders might, in fact, be on the verge of working out a compromise that would reopen the government by until January 15th and raise the debt limit until February 7th. The deadline for that, of course, is Thursday when the government will run out of money. But as we heard from Janet Cook of the Wall Street Journal, members of the House wanted to put their stamp on a bill. They then apparently are still debating a measure and whether to add to the Senate a bill. That has slowed down the process of the Senate compromise that was being worked out. Let us look ahead at what this might mean for the future. Ezra Klein is domestic policy columnist at the Washington Post. He's also editor of Wonk Blog. Good as always to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
You have said that the basic problems, and particularly a division in the Republican Party, goes well beyond what we're hearing about the differences right now. Tell us about that and what it might mean even for next year's elections.
Right. So we're in a situation now, and I think this has been the interesting dimension of this whole debate. The core argument has not actually been between Democrats and Republicans. It's been between different factions of the Republican Party. If it had been up to Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, there would have never been a shutdown. Every single one of them, every single member of the Republican leadership opposed the Ted Cruz defund Obamacare or shut down the government strategy. they lost. And then they kept kind of losing the ability to try to reopen the government using a clean CR, as it's called, a clean government funding bill. So one of the things you're having right now in the Republican Party is a kind of a civil war. And war might be a bit strong of a word, but it's definitely a factional battle. And it's one that, interestingly, is not being won by the leadership, which is typically not how these things go. It used to be the leadership, the core function a congressional leadership will play is to sort of calm the wings of the party and make sure that the party as a whole does things that make sense for it in the next election, basically. At this point, the party as a whole is being sort of dominated or driven in the other way, with the leadership submitting to strategies that they think don't make sense for them in the next election, but that have the function of pleasing and sort of demonstrating a fealty to the ideological opinions of their most core supporters.
Now, this also brings up the question of the Hastert rule, so-called, which is that a speaker won't allow anything to go to the floor unless a majority of the caucus supports it. So this is why, since they have these divisions within the party and within the caucus in Congress, that nothing has gone to the floor. So the Democrats haven't been able to chime in on this at all.
Well, there's a bit of that. But what's interesting, and what you'll hear both folks on the left and the right complain about with Speaker Boehner, is it right? The Hastert rule says you need a majority of the majority. So that would be, I think what we have 234 Republicans or so, so something like 117 Republicans. And I could be slightly misremembering the number. But that has actually not been the issue here. People really believe that that many Republicans, that many House Republicans are with Boehner. The thing that Boehner appears to be using, and it's very undefined at this point, is something people like to call a super Hastert rule. And the dimension of this changes kind of depending on who's explaining it. One way some people think Boehner's been governing or trying to govern, certainly during the shutdown, is by saying he's not going to bring anything to the floor unless it can pass with only Republican votes, which is a much, much higher margin than simply getting 117. Now you need 218. Another version of the idea is that he's not bringing it to the floor unless it's kind of undefined 30 or 40 or 50 Tea Party members who seem to be very, very important to the conservative base agree to it, in which case that's not even really a minority of the minority. It's kind of a faction of the minority. So what Boehner is doing is a little bit unclear, and it's really based around his kind of impression of where the power lies in the Republican Party right now. But one difficulty with that is that it's nothing so formalized as a rule. And as such, it's hard for people to predict how it's going to work or how it can be worked around. It really sort of depends on Boehner's personal judgment about where the politics lie. And the last thing I should say on this, of course, is that that's true with the Hastert rule, too. The Hastert rule is not a rule. It's simply something that speakers can do or not do as they choose. It's not written down anywhere. And John Boehner breaks it routinely and might end up having to break it in this debate, too.
Okay. Now, in the meantime, this is hard enough for those of us who are part of the chattering class to understand, but the people around the country are now saying that they feel that the Republicans are to blame for what appears to be a disaster in Washington. And you've said one of the principal numbers we ought to be talking about is 74. What do you mean?
So the Washington Post ABC News poll, which was released on Monday, found that 74% of the country disapproves of how the Republican Party is following the budget strategy they're following. You should not see the number 74% disapproval in a poll on a major, highly visible issue in American politics ever, right? We have a competitive two-party system. The way it's supposed to work is both parties orient themselves to be approved of, orient their major strategies such that they're appealing to, you know, what we call the median voter, the 51st percentile, the people who will win an election. When you have a party that is following a strategy that has brought them to 74% disapproval, and it's not just that poll, by the way. We've had NBC polls and Gallup polls showing the Republican Party is now less popular than at any time since we've actually been polling that question. When you have a party following a strategy that is doing that to the party, that means something is not working, right? It means something in the sort of normal equilibrating mechanisms of government is beginning to fail. Now, I think that the Republican Party has made itself so unpopular that it is at this point really looking for an exit strategy, but it shouldn't have ever gotten to this point. And so, on the one hand, that number is providing the pressure that will be needed probably to bring this thing to some kind of a safe close, although we can't say that for sure yet. On the other hand, the fact that we've gotten here at all suggests that, again, some of the sort of moderating functions of the two political parties, or of the Republican Party primarily, are not working in the way they have typically worked historically.
Ezra Klein again, a domestic policy columnist at The Washington Post. Timothy Carney, a senior political columnist at The Washington Examiner. He's a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute as well, and he's author of Obamanomics. Timothy Carney, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
How did the Republican Party get this way, and what does it have to do with its sources of funding?
Well, the Democratic Party has two major sources of funding. They have business and business lobbyists, and they have labor unions. And last decade, they started to develop, people would call it net roots, sort of a grassroots fundraising network. So it was two, three sources of funding. The Republican Party long only had one source of funding, which was a big business lobby. We call it K Street here in D.C. It's a corridor of lobbying downtown here. But the internet sort of ended that, then Barack Obama's ability to sort of win over big business, win over the drug companies on Obamacare, then the bailout happened right before that. So there started to be a rift between sort of free market conservatives and the big business lobby, a rift that was always there a little, and it grew a lot. And technology allowed people to be able to go and raise sort of from the conservative grassroots, from conservative billionaires, from, you know, just regular old rich retired Republicans. So suddenly there was a second base of money in the Republican Party, and I call it the Tea Party base of money. And so that was a different pull than the big business pull, which might often be for deregulations and tax cuts, but is often for bailouts or maybe for regulations that protect them from industry. So all of a sudden now, not every Republican cares what Wall Street or what K Street thinks about them, and so that means that they're not necessarily going to listen when their leadership says to jump.
So what does that mean as far as you're concerned for the future, particularly when 74% of Americans say they think the Republicans have blown it?
Well, I think that Republicans have needed to shake free of sort of the K Street, Wall Street grip on them. That dynamic got in the way of them ever actually looking for sort of free market policy in a consistent way. The problem is that at the moment, the people who sort of grab the reins on this this Tea Party wing don't have experience leading. Ted Cruz is a freshman senator. He's been in the Senate for just a few months. So while, you know, freshmen can play a very good role of sort of trying to keep leadership honest, right now he's sort of steered the ship and probably steered it into a cul-de-sac as far as I see it. So, I mean, the optimistic interpretation for a conservative Republican would be these are sort of growing pains, coming out of being a K Street-dominated party and figuring out how it can be a party where the Tea Party is exerting real influence.
Timothy Carney, again, with the Washington Examiner and the American Enterprise Institute. Ezra Klein, back to you with the Washington Post. Did Ted Cruz, do you think, misplay? Do you agree with Timothy Carney?
It depends on what you think Ted Cruz is playing for, right? I mean, Ted Cruz is, to some degree, a bigger name at this point. He's arguably a bigger hero to the conservative grassroots. He has shown, in a way people did not recognize, that he has tremendous influence or the capacity to wield tremendous influence inside the Republican Party. So if Ted Cruz believes on some level that he wants to run sort of an insurgent conservative effort to win the Republican nomination in 2016, maybe not, right? Maybe this was a smart strategy. I mean, one interpretation of what's happening in the Republican Party right now is that they're facing a lot of collective action problems in that the incentives that face individual politicians in the party, for them to follow them, it's bad for the party as a whole, and that Ted Cruz is simply sort of taking advantage of that. That said, you know, one thing that I think has been notable about Cruz, and this is something I didn't expect, and it's hard to say if it's cynical or it's honest, is that in a series of speeches he's been giving lately, he's been evincing, I think, a view of the political system and the culture and the numbers that is a little bit hard to believe. He's sort of, you know, had this kind of, we have the Democrats right where we want them. If you really read the polls correctly, the polls are great for us. Or he said that he doesn't believe the polls. So, you know, it's made me start to wonder, whereas originally I sort of viewed Ted Cruz as a pretty smart, you know, tactician, even if a bit extreme, it's made me a little bit wonder how clear his view of politics is, or if he lives in a bit of an echo chamber, you know, of his own and of sort of the wing of his party that he's from. If so, that would imply that possibly he's not, you know, following strategies that are all that well-founded and will continue to do so in ways that won't make this kind of thing effective for him because he won't know when to pull back on the throttle, even for his own interest.
And Timothy Carney, is he getting the same kind of support you described earlier that the Tea Party Republicans in the House are getting?
He's certainly getting a ton of support from sort of dedicated conservative activists, and you know, there's a huge group of people out there who would want him to run for president because he's doing this.
All right. Again, we're talking with Timothy Carney and Ezra Klein. This is To the Point from PRI. Let me introduce Ryan Lizza. He's Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. Good to have you in our program.
Hello, everyone.
Tell us about these Tea Party Republicans who are thumbing their noses at their leaders. And how solid are they in terms of being able to be reelected next year? And to what extent do they differ or do they represent people who differ very much from what we think of as the mainstream of American politics and thinking?
Yeah, well, on the first question about how solid most of the House Tea Party folks are, the ones who Ezra was describing as pushing the GOP leadership into this course, you know, they're all pretty solid. I mean, generally, if you're elected to the House of Representatives, you're 90% chance you're going to be reelected. But we are living in an age where on both sides they have supermajority districts, and part of that is because of redistricting and gerrymandering, but more than that, it's just people live in clusters, and it's hard to actually draw districts that are ideologically diverse with, you know, 50% Democrats and 50% Republicans. So I looked at the 80 Republicans who signed this letter pushing, demanding that Boehner basically take the course he took. If you look at their districts, they on average, Barack Obama lost in 2012 by 23 points. And these Republicans, and they're all Republicans, obviously, won on average of by an average of 34 points. So as many people have pointed out, they don't fear a Democratic opponent. They don't fear liberals or moderates. They fear a conservative challenge in a primary. So what they're doing is quite popular back home. All of the sort of national trends that we all write about, what we all wrote about after the election, you know, in terms of a diversifying country, in terms of Republicans needing to appeal to Latinos, and many of the issues that the RNC talked about in its report after the election, a lot of those trends just don't really bother them because in their districts, that's not the way it is. On the Tea Party and where it fits in with the Republican Party, you know, it's interesting. I was interviewing someone who's advising a Republican who's probably going to run for president in 2016. And I asked him, you know, tell me how you view the Republican Party. How do you slice it up right now? And he said, you know, in the old days we had that three-legged stool. We would talk about national security conservatives, values conservatives, or the Christian conservatives who cared about things like abortion, and then economic conservatives who were mostly a little bit more libertarian, mostly just cared about low taxes. And those were the three legs of the stool. He said we still think of those three groups, but there's a new group that is just its own entity, and that is the Tea Party. So it really, you know, I think there was a lot of commentary early on when the Tea Party came to prominence that these are just very conservative Republicans, not all that different than very conservative Republicans over the last few decades. But it does seem to be changing into a more separate entity. And in the House, I mean, frankly, in the House, what you're moving towards is almost a separate party. The factional, the divide that Ezra was talking about on the Republican side, which is really the whole story here, it operates in some ways like a distinct party with its own meetings and its own tactics, and not as part of the House GOP conference.
Okay, we'll come back and continue this conversation in a moment. Ezra Klein is going to leave us. He's domestic policy columnist at the Washington Post, editor of Wonk Blog. Thank you very much for being on our program. On our talking point later, the U.S. Supreme Court takes another look at affirmative action. We'll talk about that. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
We're only back with To the Point as the Congress gets down to the wire on raising the debt limit and reopening the government. The debt limit, of course, expiring on Thursday when the government will run out of money. We're talking about the divisions within the GOP and the extent to which they have caused the crisis and the depth of the divisions that people see. Ryan Lizza, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, just said that he thinks maybe a third party might come out of this. Is it that formalized, do you think?
Well, you know, the third parties in American politics need an issue. Most of the third, our system really is almost forces things to move towards two parties. And when a third party does come along, usually what happens is that it is addressing an issue that neither the two major parties are addressing. You know, so Ross Perot, the big one, was reducing the deficit. But once the Republicans and the Democrats both, under pressure from Perot's Reform Party, started addressing that issue, the Reform Party went away. The historian who once described third parties like bees, they sting and then they die. So the question for the Tea Party is, what is that issue that they could really coalesce around that the Republican Party is not addressing? And so right now, I don't think there's enough there for the Tea Party to be, to split off on its own, and frankly, not the incentive for them to do it, because ideologically, there's still a lot of overlap between these factions we're talking about, although there's major differences on a tactical and strategic level. But in the House of Representatives, in that one body, the Tea Party is operating as a sort of separate entity, and one that's not subject to the same sort of carrots and sticks that factions in the past have been subject to. And, you know, we can talk about why that is. But as Ezra was explaining earlier, Boehner he doesn't have the ability to control that faction the way, say, that Denny Hastert did in the Bush era. And that's his big problem. I mean, the factions have always existed in the House, but the problem now is that the leadership is having a tough time controlling them.
Timothy Carney, back to you with the Washington Examiner and the Enterprise Institute, author of Obamanomics. You said earlier that the Tea Party people have new funding sources. They're not dependent on the K Street lobbyists anymore and big business. They are independent of that. You have suggested that maybe corporate welfare would be an issue that the Republicans might want to seize on.
I do think that if they were looking for an issue that would separate them, as Ryan is saying, from sort of the current and old Republican Party and from the Obama administration, it would be going after the corporate welfare programs that President Obama likes. One problem is Republicans have typically gone along with a lot of these, including a sugar program that keeps out foreign sugar to help U.S. Sugar companies and kills candy companies, makes groceries more expensive. There are subsidies for all sorts of exports, subsidies for all sorts of energy, both green energy and fossil fuel. And it would be a way of being both limited government and populist that the party could tap into in a way that a Republican Party never previously could, because they couldn't afford to upset big business. I happen to think that would have some political appeal. I'm biased because those are my own views, so you should take with a grain of salt when I say that the public will like them too. But I think that would definitely be an interesting way for sort of a Tea Party wing to go and try to lead the GOP.
Ryan Lizza, do you think that makes sense?
Yeah, that seems to be the big fault line. I mean, I go back and forth on this, and so sometimes this divide, you know, you really have to squint sometimes to see what the big ideological differences are between, you know, Boehner and the Republican leadership in the House and the Tea Party folks that are making his life miserable. I mean, right, they all agree on defunding Obamacare. They all agree on cutting spending as much as they can. So on the big issues, there's a lot of agreement, but as Tim has pointed out, and as he's written about quite a bit, there is a divide on how much deference and respect to show towards big business and Wall Street. I think it's an important point that as conservatives rely less and less on those funding sources, they can sort of start to carve out, or the Tea Party can start to carve out a more ideologically distinct agenda. On the other hand, sometimes I struggle to see what the issues are. For instance, look at financial regulation. That should be an issue where, if what Tim is saying is correct, that the Tea Party should really be in a different place than most of the sort of Republican establishment. But from what I can tell, most of the Tea Party folks are against the regulatory regime that the Obama administration set up, and they'd be happy to repeal Dodd-Frank. So on some of those, you know, sometimes where the rubber hits the road, I don't see that divide.
Okay, we've talked a lot about the divisions within the Republican Party. Democracy requires, of course, compromise with the two parties when you have a two-party system. And, of course, the last time that the government was shut down was during the Newt Gingrich era in the 1990s, the Newt Gingrich era, the Clinton era, whatever you want to call it. Lauren Maddox was a spokesperson for House Speaker Gingrich and former communications director for the House Republican Conference. She's now a political strategist at Podesta Group. That's a lobbying firm in Washington, D.C., lobbies for issues and interests for both parties. Lauren Maddox, good to have you on our program.
Warren, thanks for having me on.
What is the issue that, well, I should say in Politico, you raised a very interesting issue that we haven't talked about on this program, and that is how it is that current communications technology and the way the media operates have made compromise even more difficult than it was in the 1990s. Elaborate on that.
Sure. So we have more openness today, but less trust, and the American people like government less today than they ever have. So I got to thinking, why is that? And I think part of the problem is that the cameras have created this sort of reality show atmosphere where everyone wants to be on the equivalent of the Jumbotron at a stadium. The wilder they dance, the more likely it is they're going to appear on the big screen. As well, the rise of punditry. There is, I think, way too much speculation about policymakers' motives. One of my favorite examples of this is a bike ride that three senators took together along the Potomac River one day as they were negotiating the as part of the supercommittee, and it was Republican Rob Portman from Ohio and Democratic Senator Mark Warner from Virginia and then Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, and there was wild speculation that went on for hours about whether or not we were close to a grand deal on the super committee because they were all out biking. You know, maybe it was just a nice day and they all like to bike and they're strong competitors, but it's making it harder, I think, for them to socialize together if they're out to dinner. It's speculated about, that sort of thing. And I would point to one other thing. I think there are many more what I would call citizen journalists who are pushing out a lot of opinion and analysis, and I recognize the power and importance of social media today, but I think sometimes the public is confused about what is analysis and what is information that's actually been vetted. So I think while the news is more interactive, and I think that's a good thing, I think it's also important that we respect those old values in journalism of accuracy and in context, and make sure that all this content that's moving out is put into context and that there's good sourcing so we know where the information is coming from.
Well, there's no control on the content, but you have free speech United States. Isn't it up to the politicians, if they really want to govern and want to compromise and want democracy to work, to figure out ways to adjust to these new realities?
So I think that's right. It just gives everybody a platform. I guess the question is, you know, I think it's important to provide some context. I think it's if without perspective, it's like looking at a 2x2-inch square of the Mona Lisa. You've got to step back. You've got to take in the full picture. And I think a good reporter is going to provide you with that full picture. And I think we get a lot of content, but sometimes we're missing the context. And I think that's confusing for people.
So has that, do you think, also led in part to the divisions within the Republican Party? Are certain people, such as those described by Ryan Lizza, who live in places which are less diverse rather than more diverse, different from the nation as a whole, are they just talking to one another?
I think they're talking to the cameras and they're not talking to each other, and we need to get them talking to each other. And I think, you know, look at what's going on the Hill today. The Senate's got its own proposal. The House is looking at its own proposal. I mean, they just need to get with the White House and they need to fix this. They got to get the government back open again. They've got to raise the debt ceiling and get to some sort of a regular order.
Well, Ryan Lizza, back to you with The New Yorker. The impression I got from you and your description of the Tea Party Republicans is they don't want to talk to other people.
Look, and you know, the way, if you want to fix things in politics, usually the way to do it is to create an incentive structure so people have some incentive to do it. I mean, our system is premised on a relatively pessimistic assumptions about human nature, right? The founders didn't assume that everyone would just do their best. So, how do you encourage Tea Party, or on the right, or Democrats on the left who live in very safe districts and sometimes don't have an incentive to compromise? That's a tough question, because that gets you into some serious process reforms about redistricting, and once you get into that, you start questioning majority minority districts and all sorts of issues. On this issue of transparency, and it seems like the conversation you were just having is about whether transparency is harming our democracy. We have, the healthcare law in 2009 and 2010 was almost derailed because basically people found out too much about it. A lot of what almost killed that law were these special deals that had to be cut. In a previous era, special deals that had to be cut were just considered the sort of lubricant for the legislative process, and people often didn't really find out about them until after the fact. For instance, when Johnson passed Medicare, they didn't even have a Congressional Budget Office. They basically just made up all the numbers and estimates. If they actually knew how much it was going to cost, they probably wouldn't have passed it. And so I take your point about how the super transparent process now makes things really, really, really difficult, because nobody can get in a quiet room and sort of cut a deal without their base freaking out in real time on Twitter. At the same time, I don't really see any solution for that. There's no going back. The transparency is probably a net plus. And of course, as a journalist, it's sort of my lifeblood, so I wouldn't speak ill of it.
Well, do you think, though, as Lauren Maddox is suggesting, that it imposes special responsibilities on journalists to provide perspective and provide a context, or is that just a matter for individuals?
No, of course. I mean, who would be against telling journalists to provide context? But I don't really see. That's important. Journalists should do the best they can to provide voters with as much information, as much context as possible. But I don't really see going back to an era where spying a few legislators out taking a walk is not going to be reported and commented on and discussed and perhaps affect negotiations. That is the world we live in right now.
Lauren Maddox, back to you. The speaker you worked for, Newt Gingrich, in the 1990s, has often accused of having begun the era of partisanship by being willing to go all the way to shutting down the government. How do you think the current speaker is doing?
So I think the optics of this are bad. I think, John Boehner was on Newt's leadership team in the 90s, and I thought we were going to avoid this. But I think the optics are bad, and I think they should.
And he should have learned from the past.
Reopen the government. I think Ryan actually talked about it very well and eloquently. I think, he's kind of in a tough position, and I agree. He has no carrots and no sticks like Newt had in the past. No sweeteners for the bills and that sort of thing. So he's having a tough time with his caucus right now. But, again, I go back to, it was certainly a different time back then. There were, Republicans controlled both houses in 95 and 96. There are fewer competitive districts today, meaning the House is more conservative. And I think, as Timothy pointed out, members are in safe seats, and they don't concern themselves so much with the national polls. Rather, they're more focused on the majority block of voters in their home district. So it's a little bit more every man for himself as opposed to the party. So that's changed. So I think he's having a tough go of it, but and I frankly don't know whether he's got the votes in the House to pass the latest proposal, but we'll see soon enough.
Back to Timothy Carney, what about presidential politics? Certainly, at some point, presidential candidates have to look at the national polls, even though we do vote by state rather than as a nation. Do you think, for example, that Ted Cruz has enough time, has enough going for him, that he could become a serious candidate despite the fact that he is regarded by so many as having backed the Republicans into this situation where they now find themselves?
for all this talk about Republicans becoming an extreme party, I'll point out that somebody like Ted Cruz, in other words, you know, a conservative anti-establishment firebrand, has not won the Republican nomination since, you know, 1964 when Barry Goldwater got it, and that was about the only time that it ever happened. Typically, it's the establishment-favored moderate, and 2012 was a post-Tea Party election, and the most lukewarm, most milquetoast, most establishment candidate, Mitt Romney, fairly easily won the nomination. So I think Ted Cruz in the long run could become something like a Ronald Reagan, which is a establishment-respected conservative. I think it'll take a few years, a couple cycles before that happens. But, you know, whoever the establishment and the establishment type, the majority leader, the minority leader in the Senate, the Speaker, are both people. None of them are people who were put in by sort of Tea Party coups. Even the head of the Republican Study Committee, which is a conservative wing there in the House, that's Steve Scalise, who was the leadership's pick for that. So there's certainly a lot of, anger and sort of disorder coming up from the bottom. But the top levels of the Republican Party, the base sort of always ends up picking the establishment moderate guy. So it's not going to be Ted Cruz this time around, or I'd be very surprised.
Lauren Maddox, what do you say to that? Is it possible that Ted Cruz could come out of this as a new Ronald Reagan, or is the guy, if he gets blamed for it, who counseled everybody to shut down the government, simply not going to be acceptable?
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be the nominee in 2016. I would be surprised about that. I think the big takeaway in this latest battle, while it made for good drama, I think, for House members, it's that he couldn't do anything for him in the Senate. For at least for that faction in the House that supported, his tactic back a few weeks ago. So I don't necessarily see that happening.
On the other hand, Ryan Lizza, you're talking about Tea Party Republicans that come from states where mainly in the South, where people pretty much agree with Ted Cruz's positions, apparently. What do you say? Does he have, do you think, a chance at least to make a showing at the Republican convention, or is the establishment going to find a way, despite the fact that it's less well funded than it used to be, to maintain its control?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Tim on this, and there's a good book recently by John Sides and Lynn Vavreck about the 2012 election, two political scientists, and they prove conclusively in the their study of Republican primary and caucus voters that electability is actually more important to Republican primary voters than purism. And so, we're talking a lot about the Tea Party and how it's a faction and how conservative it is, but it's important to remember that it doesn't represent 100% of the Republican Party. There are these still ideological divides, and you still need to appeal to a coalition of conservatives in the primaries. And as Tim pointed out, usually the establishment candidate wins. Now, on the other hand, the new campaign finance regime does allow or give a bigger opportunity for a sort of more of a Cruz-like insurgent, right? Because you have super PACs, and if you remember the 2012 primaries, Newt Gingrich had one sugar daddy, and he lasted a long time because of it.
Okay, we're way ahead of ourselves. We haven't reopened the government yet or resolved the debt limit issue. But thank you all very much for being with us. Ryan Lizza with The New Yorker, Timothy Carney with The Washington Examiner and the American Enterprise Institute, author of Obamanomics, Lauren Maddox, formerly with Speaker Newt Gingrich, now at the Podesta Group, a lobbying firm in Washington. Great to have all of you with us. In 2006, Michigan voters banned the use of race to decide admission to public universities. Last year, an appellate court ruled that violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on both sides, as we'll hear in a moment on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
We're not only back with today's talking point. The U.S. Supreme Court has limited affirmative action in past cases. It has never banned the practice nationwide, as did the voters of Michigan. Today's case, of course, provides that opportunity if the justices choose to go that way. It was heard by 8 of the 9 justices. The former Solicitor General of the United States, Elena Kagan, recused herself. Greg Storr is a Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg. He's author of the book A Black and White Case, How Affirmative Action Survived Its Greatest Legal Challenge. He was in the court today. Greg Storr, good to have you with us. What'd you hear?
Always good to be on with you, Warren. Well, I heard a Supreme Court that seemed supportive of the Michigan ballot initiative and the effort there to ban affirmative action. Certainly was very hard to count to enough votes to find justices who would have struck it down.
What are the arguments against the Michigan initiative?
The argument is basically this, that it sets up a system where a black student or a black family who, or a Latino family who wants a special preference at the University of Michigan has a much higher hurdle to climb than, say, the child of an alumnus of the University of Michigan. In other words, that child of an alumnus can still get special preferences from the university without having to go through the arduous process of trying to get a constitutional amendment, but black families cannot do that. That was the argument against it. Did not get too much traction today at the Supreme Court.
So when you wrote about affirmative action surviving its greatest legal challenge, are you going to have to write a new book?
It is certainly a different world than it was back then in 2003. Then, of course, Justice O'Connor was still on the court and cast the deciding vote in allowing affirmative action. The Supreme Court, in a decision last year, limited it or ordered tougher court scrutiny of affirmative action. And then we have this case this year, which by all appearances in the courtroom today will mean that at least in Michigan, the very state, the very university that won that victory in 2003, at least in that state, at state schools, there will not be race-based admissions.
So what about the idea that the possibility that the court could not just affirm this case in Michigan, but rule that it applies to other states as well?
Warren, that doesn't seem like a likely possibility, and here's the reason. What this case is about is whether the voters of Michigan can effectively say, as a matter of our state law, our state constitution, we are not going to allow racial preferences. And so while the Supreme Court ruling could potentially allow other states to do that as well, it wouldn't actually have the effect of banning affirmative actions in those states. It would just mean that those states, if they wanted to, could also ban them as a matter of state law.
Greg Storr, again, a Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg. Emily Bazelon is with us, senior editor at Slate.com and the Truman Capote Fellow at the Yale Law School. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much.
You have written that the problem that is faced by people of color in this country really isn't so much based on race itself as it is on class. What do you mean by that?
When you look at the real inequity and fairness problem in college admissions right now, the biggest problem is the very tiny representation of low-income students at selective schools and at leading state universities. And so one concern about race-based affirmative action is that it just doesn't do enough to pull poor students into school, that it is generally benefiting affluent minority kids who perhaps should also get a boost in admissions but shouldn't be the only recipients of preferential treatment.
Is there any way that the court could incorporate that analysis into this decision on this case?
You know, here's how it could come up. You know, Greg is absolutely right. They are probably going to allow states to ban affirmative action, and they could say that one of the legitimate reasons the government has to pass that kind of law is that there are alternative remedies, alternative ways of making admissions more fair. And so they could point to some of the research showing that it's actually been in the 10 states that have banned affirmative action that more interesting alternatives have been proposed. So, for example, there are 3 states that have stopped doing legacy preference admissions. In other words, giving kids a boost because their parents went to that school. When you see those kinds of changes, that's when you imagine a world in which, oh, we could also give kids a boost if they have very low family wealth or they come from poor neighborhoods, that kind of change.
What other issues do you think, other than the legacy admissions, might be affected?
Well, you know, what really comes into play here is financial aid, because in order for schools to admit more low-income students, they have to be willing to give more aid. And some of that aid comes from the government. We're talking about the percentage of students at a campus who are recipients of Pell Grants. But usually schools, selective schools, tend to supplement that aid. And so partly this is a financial challenge for the schools, one that the government could do more to help with, but the schools have to decide to invest more money in students who can't afford to go to college.
So Greg Storr, back to you. What are the prospects, do you think, that the current court might, in fact, interested, though, as it one assumes it must be, in equality in all areas, might in fact reach out to this kind of alternative?
Emily is exactly right in talking about this, because it's really the hot topic when it comes to university admissions, whether socioeconomic affirmative action can supplant race-based affirmative action. The interesting thing from the court standpoint, though, is the case last year out of the University of Texas really brought that issue to the forefront more directly, and the court really didn't go very far in that case. It issued a very narrow ruling, so at least right now the court doesn't appear yet ready to say that we see socioeconomic affirmative action as being an acceptable, complete alternative to traditional affirmative action.
Emily Bazelon, why do you say that this is a case that liberals deserve to lose?
You know, this is a tricky one for me. I would not have voted for Michigan's ban on affirmative action if I lived in Michigan. However, for the court to say that a state can't choose to eliminate preferential treatment based on race, I don't think that really makes sense as a reading of the current way we understand equal protection under the law. Equal protection under the law should mean, and does tend to mean, with this Supreme Court in particular, that we are treating everyone the same. And affirmative action fundamentally doesn't do that. It may not do that for good reasons, but the notion that a state's voters can't decide that they don't want to pursue that kind of admission strategy, I just don't buy it.
Greg Storr, once again, one of the liberals has recused herself. We don't know if this will go in a liberal conservative direction. Did you hear anything today from any of the justices that surprised you?
One thing that I thought was very, very interesting was Justice Sotomayor. She's the court's only Hispanic justice. And the reason that I thought it was so interesting was that last year in this case involving Texas, she agreed to what was basically a compromise that ordered tougher court scrutiny of affirmative action, and people were very surprised by that. Today, however, she was the most outspoken opponent of Prop 8 in the courtroom. She was really going hard after the Michigan lawyer.
All right, Greg Storr with Bloomberg. Thanks to you, A Black and White Case, How Affirmative Action Survived Its Greatest Legal Challenge. Emily Bazelon with Slate.com. Great to have you both on our program. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point from PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.